You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you after a weekend when Mathieu van der Poel and Wout van Aert briefly reunited at the front of a Belgian classic, but in doing so demonstrated that getting back with your ex is never a good idea unless Jasper Philipsen's around to clean up the mess. My name is Daniel Freeburn and I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll discuss a weekend of racing that was in many ways a throwback, but also perhaps a glimpse into the near future with the big one, the Ronde van Vlaanderen, or the Tour of Flanders, coming at the weekend. Joining me to do that today is the Van Aert to my Van der Poel, the Ben Affleck to my Jennifer Lopez. It's Lionel Burney. After a week away, Lionel reunited. You weren't with Larry and me last week, but yeah, reunited.
No, well, I think we're all feeling a little under the weather, aren't we? The illness sweeping through the Cycling Podcast team at the moment. You're wrapped up warm there, Daniel. I think I'm a few days ahead of you. I'll definitely be fit for the Tour of Flanders, but maybe wouldn't have made Gent-Wevelgem. Oh, or in Flanders Fields, as we now have to call it.
No, that was... I noted with some satisfaction that the name change has been met with the same lack of enthusiasm, antipathy almost, not apathy, antipathy, with which we have met it. Didn't even make an attempt in Wednesday's podcast to even look up the new name, let alone use it. Apologies to Flanders Classics. Maybe next year we'll give it a go.
I think the In Flanders Fields bit is obviously a nod to the rerouting. I mean, that's not even a new thing now, is it? The race has been going through the Ploeg Streets, the old battlefields of the First World War. That's coming up to a decade, I think, since they made that significant route change and really altered the character of Gent-Wevelgem, which was always a kind of the crosswinds type classic, wasn't it? Often went the way of the sprinters, but the gravelly roads has changed the character, I think, added an awful lot to the race. The In Flanders Fields was a kind of suffix for a while, and now they've put that to the front. It's the second bit that's unwieldy, from Middelkerke to Wevelgem. I guess that gives Middelkerke, who have paid some money to host the start for the next however many years, that gives them some billing in the race title. And I suppose that's the bit that will get edited and changed over the years if the start's in Ypres one year or Harelbeke or wherever it happens to be. The women's race is called from Wevelgem to Wevelgem. So In Flanders Fields, I kind of get it, but it's going to be a long few years before I stop thinking of it as Gent-Wevelgem.
Does it matter, Lionel? Because we have remarked on these name changes with some mirth and, as I said, scorn, I suppose, in recent weeks. And there have been a lot of them this year. There have been a lot of them always in professional cycling. Names do change. And like you say, usually it's because of commercial imperatives, and particularly, I suppose, we see as the financial pressures on races have become greater and greater, and the financial pressure in the sport has become greater and greater, then race organisers are more and more willing to accept funding from, for example, local tourist boards and so on and so forth, and they need that funding, and usually it comes with the compromise of having to change their name. And that's what's driving this, particularly, you know, think about the Dauphiné being renamed the Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes Tour, which none of us like. But does it really matter? Because in other sports, this doesn't really happen. You know, US Masters will never not be the US Masters. It won't be the Augusta, I don't know, Chevrolet Open.
No, but I think there's tiers of to this, isn't there? The US Masters might not be, but there are a lot of golf tournaments that are sponsored, yes, by corporations and have the name of the corporation as the event title. And it's the same in cycling, isn't it? It's ironic that we're bemoaning or mourning the loss of the Dauphiné. The Dauphiné, of course, is a brand, isn't it? It was a newspaper.
Yes and no. Yes, well, and no. It, yes, was. It refers to an ancient region of France, which in turn gave its name to a newspaper, which in turn gave its name to the race.
Sure, but I mean, the reason the race was called the Dauphiné was because it was funded and sponsored by the newspaper group, right? I mean, it opens the door, doesn't it? I suppose it's preferable to have In Flanders Fields as the new name rather than, I don't know, the Proximus Classic or I'm trying to think of some Belgian brands off the top of my head. I don't know, the Delhaize Classic, the Jupiler Classic, for example. You know, we've got the E3 Saxo Classic. I mean, talk about esoteric. I mean, that's named after a motorway that's long since changed its name, and Saxo is a title sponsor. I think maybe it gives the organisers some real estate to sell in future years. I could certainly see some of these races having a corporate name. But the one that will never change in people's minds will be the Ronde van Vlaanderen and the Tour of Flanders. And I think there'll be certain things in cycling that, you know, would remain untouched and untainted by name changes for corporate reasons. If not officially, then certainly in the minds of ourselves and the fans. I mean, is anyone going to call Paris-Roubaix Haute de France this year? No, they're not. They're going to call it Paris-Roubaix, as they have done for over a century. But then the Amstel Gold Race, I mean, if that changed from being sponsored and so deeply identified with the brand, the brewery brand, I mean, I couldn't imagine calling that something other than Amstel. It just wouldn't work. But yeah, it's, there's no one consistent answer here, is there?
No. Some of them over the years have been a little bit unfathomable. The RCS races, the renaming of those, to in an effort to sort of sequester the word Giro Tour for the Giro d'Italia and to keep it away from any of the other real estate in the RCS portfolio. That's why we have Il Lombardia, not Il Giro di Lombardia anymore. I just think is a bit of a nonsense. Anyway, we could probably go on about this for hours, but we wouldn't have many listeners left. Lionel, I also made up I said Chevroline. Of course, I think I was sort of caught between two brand names. Chevrolet, US Masters, Chevrolet. Anyway, Lionel, just a couple of things I wanted to mention before we get on to the serious business of Classics Chat, Cobbled Classics Chat. Some curious couple of bits of news in the last few hours. One about a gentleman who will be coming into professional cycling for the first time, a biathlete, the Frenchman, Emilien Jacquelin, one of the best biathletes in the world, one of the stars, I guess you would say one of the stars of the recent Winter Olympics, in the sense that he won a gold medal and a bronze medal.
Remind me, what's biathlon?
Biathlon is shooting rifles and cross-country skiing.
Logical bedfellows.
There you go. Emilien Jacquelin is going to be, or attempt, well, he will be, he's becoming a professional cyclist of sorts. He's joining Decathlon's feeder team initially. Who knows, one day may make the step up to their World Tour team. But this won't be the only piece of sort of recent news about him and cycling, because he briefly made headlines before the Winter Olympics. Because as a youth, he was a huge fan of professional cycling and a huge fan in particular of Marco Pantani, Il Pirata. And so much so that through friends, he'd managed to get in touch with Pantani's parents before Milano Cortina. And he'd come, he'd been lent one of Pantani's old earrings. And he vowed, and he duly did, wear this earring for the Winter Olympics. And, it served him well, won a gold and a bronze medal, as I said. So it'd be interesting to see how he gets on. He's sort of built, I would say, more like a classics rider. We don't really know what kind of rider he's going to be. He's obviously got a lot of cycling experience. He grew up cycling with a former, I think he retired last year, Nance Peters, former decathlon rider in the Grenoble area.
Interesting. Biathlon makes me think, I mean, you know, no gun shooting in cycling, but I have invented years ago, I'm sure I've talked about this on the podcast before, I think an indoor sport for the Winter Olympics, turbo darts, very similar to biathlon. You have to sit on the turbo trainer and ride at least 180 watts and then play darts. I can see this is a sort of indoor cycling that wouldn't appeal to you, Daniel. No indoor cycling appeals to you, does it?
Alas, no, I don't think so, Lionel. That's not really my bag. I'm just looking. I thought I'd done Nance Peters a terrible disservice there and said they'd retired when he actually hadn't, but he has retired. He retired at a fairly young age, however, 32. A rider whose career actually slightly baffled me in the sense that just when he seemed to be going places, he's just lost all momentum in his career and has now retired. Anyway, Lionel, so that's Emilien Jacquelin. A more familiar presence in the pro peloton, Domenico Pozzovivo. Familiar up until just over a year ago when he did retire at the end of 2024. In fact, he retired. He is supposedly making a comeback extraordinarily because Domenico Pozzovivo is 43 years of age. Now, we won't be seeing him at the Giro d'Italia because he is supposedly joining the Italian Solution Tech Nippo team, but we may be seeing him on the key Giro d'Italia warm-up races, Tour of the Alps. That's been sort of penciled in as his comeback race. We don't really know what he's thinking, where he hopes to go with this comeback, but why not? If he feels that he can still cut the mustard in the pro peloton, why not, Domenico?
You're never too old, I guess.
There's still time for me yet.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the Cycling Podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance, because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to BICMO.com to get covered. That's BICMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel any time. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
Studies show that 100% of everybody in the world wants to curl up indoors and do nothing because it's so darn cold out there. That's why many people are turning to Bombas, whose pillowy plush slippers and warm merino wool socks have been said to be the most comfortable in the history of feet. Bombas products have been found to boost coziness by up to 1 million percent. Okay, enough fake statistics, but could Bombas socks and slippers really be the cure? Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code AUDIO.
You're a pro at running your life, at committing to your workout, at showing up every day. At Bombas, we're pros too. Pros at making socks. Our sport assortment has specialized socks for whatever sport you're committed to. Running, hiking, golf, Pilates, and so much more. Made with sweat-wicking yarns, blister-fighting details, and targeted arch support. Bombas Sport is pro-level socks from the pros of socks. For another pro, you. Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com and use code AUDIO.
Well, Lionel, the holy week of the classic season is sort of on the horizon, and that week is the week that really encompasses the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. However, another kind of holy week of sorts began on Friday with E3. What's it called now, Lionel? E3 Harelbeke?
Well, it's the E3 Saxo Classic. It goes from Harelbeke to Harelbeke. I mean, point of order, Daniel, really, the renamed Ronde van Brugge or Tour of Bruges kind of kicks it all off. A little bit of a low-key race, I think. I mean, I think it's a travesty that this is a World Tour race. I mean, it's such a kind of far from ideal course, really. It's a lot of obstacles, road furniture, very flat. It's one for the sprinters. Should just mention, really, Dylan Groenewegen got a very big win for Unibet Rose Rockets in that race ahead of Jasper Philipsen and Max Kanter. Obviously, Groenewegen's sprint coach, Marcel Kittel. I don't know whether he had much to do with working the magic, but That dodged all of the various obstacles. There was even a climate protest. Somebody sat on the cobbles and caused a crash. There were echelons all over the place. It all came back together with 20-odd or kilometres to go. There was a late move by Max Valscheid of Lidl Trek. XDS Astana were trying to hold it all together for Max Kanter, but it was a win for Groenewegen, and a crash in the finale for Jayco's Arno Cappio, and he broke his collarbone in that crash. It's always a bit chaotic. I kind of watch it through my fingers, that race, really. It wasn't as bad as it has been in the past, actually. They didn't seem to go sort of sideways across the tram tracks. It's tidied up a little bit, but it doesn't feel like a World Tour status race. It feels like a kind of glorified kermesse to me.
We should say, Lionel, that Unibet Rose Rockets and Groenewegen himself, they've started like a house on fire this year. And obviously, that was a big risk for them. Big money signing. Obviously, that team is very hot on and very adept at social media. And they made a great video last year, a sort of documentary about how they pursued Groenewegen. He was sort of anointed as the guy that was going to take them up a level and reflect their growing ambitions, and they managed to get him, but I guess it was no guarantee that it was going to work as well as it has, because he's already won four races. That was their first ever World Tour win in the Ronde van Brugge. And Lionel, he has got the princely Dylan Groenewegen up to today, Monday the 30th of March, the princely total of 1,080 UCI points this year. An outstanding start to the season for him and for that team as well. They also got a win at the weekend at the Rue Tourangel in France with Clément Venturini. They had a couple of men in the breakaway yesterday in Gent-Wevelgem as well. But we will be talking about that shortly. Lionel, E3. Where were we? The name of E3, we've established what that was. And well, that was the first of the, as far as the big fixtures this weekend, it was E3 on Friday and Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday.
In Flanders Fields.
E3. Now, sort of baby Tour of Flanders, call it what you want. But this race, the course has changed over the years. It changed again this year. There were a couple of ascents up the Oude Quaremont this year, including a slightly kind of newfangled ascent of the Oude Quaremont. But one thing that remains pretty constant or pretty consistent in this race, as well as predicting the future, is a good predictor of what's going to happen in the Tour of Flanders. It tends to open up. Hostilities tend to begin on the Tyrannberg, and such was the case on Friday. 71 kilometres to go, Lionel. Do you want to tell us what happened?
Going into the race, obviously, Mathieu van der Poel has won the last two editions. So aiming for a hat-trick of wins. And you're right about the Tyrannberg. I noted that Soudal Quickstep had Tom Bonan in the car, and the Tyrannberg was, it was the hill most associated with him, wasn't it? He often attacked on that climb, and Soudal Quickstep went into the bottom of that all at the front, and it was Jasper Stuyven for them who went really hard. But he was overtaken by Tim van Dijker, and then ominously, Mathieu van der Poel reacted, and those two got away. At this point, there was a break up the road. The notable names in it, Stan de Wolf, who survived till the very end, didn't he? But also Luke Durbridge, Bystrom, Zukowski and Lambrecht were in there. They'd never really been that far ahead. There was a sort of doomed chase by a couple of riders from Picnic Post NL, Flynn and Reynard Akan, accompanied by a BH Burgos rider, Kimnek, but they never got across to the front. I suppose we should have seen what was coming, because once again, Sylvain Dillier for Alpecin Premier Tech was setting the pace on the front of the bunch. But it was that move, 70-odd kilometres to go on the Tyrannberg, which set up what ended up being an absolutely extraordinary hour and a half of racing. I mean, we can talk a bit about how the same riders are dominating the races. We've obviously talked at length about how Tadej Pogacar had rendered Strade Bianche a bit of a non-event as far as television sport is concerned. I know
thesis,
you and I have got different
thesis, not mine.
Different perspectives on that. But there's, you know, cycling is nuanced, isn't it? Yes, we had the same winner as we've had the previous 2 years. Yes, Matthew van der Poel went with his kind of trademark long escape, you know, worked his way up to, first of all, the break and then, you know, went clear. But we had a real grandstand finish, edge of the seat stuff. We'll talk about the finale in depth, I'm sure. But it was thrilling stuff, really, from that point on. And I think this is where cycling really sort of comes into its own. And I suppose it's what I was talking about when lamenting the way that Tadej Pogacar, there's very rarely any kind of cracks in the armour. This looked similar. It looked like, well, it's a done deal. Van der Poel is going to basically repeat. He's pulling off the same exploits that he's done in the past. It's in the bag, it's done and dusted, and yet it wasn't. And it wasn't because of the sort of the coagulating, ever-changing situation that was kind of unfolding behind. There were lots of different factors that meant that the finale was, well, it was in the balance until the final few hundred metres.
Yeah, he sort of was a bit of a game of snakes and ladders, wasn't it, with various, well, a couple of breaks. So he and Van Dijk got across to one move, a sort of counter move on the Bonjaberg, or just before the Bonjaberg, and then Van der Poel went on his own. So you will have read afterwards that this was a 42-kilometre solo, or 43-kilometre solo from Van der Poel. Really, it was more than that. It was because from 63 kilometres to go, he was on his own, and then he caught the first morning break, effectively, and then he dropped them on the Paterberg with 42 kilometres to go. And then Lionel... well, as you just mentioned, we saw various sort of attempts to get away behind. Antonio Morgado looked very good on the Quaremont, for example, the last time at the Quaremont, 38 kilometres to go. They really came to nothing. But then finally, with 30 kilometres to go on the Carnival Bakestraat, Per Strand Hagenes, Florian Vermeersch and Jonas Abrahamsson attacked. They caught, De Wolf was the only survivor, eventually the only survivor from the morning break. And so we had those four pursuing Van der Poel, and as you said, maybe just when we thought that everyone else's goose was cooked, the gap was never much above half a minute, was it? I don't think it was, just slightly above half a minute at one point, but we saw it getting inexorably smaller, that gap. And we did wonder whether he was going to get caught. And then when it started to get to 15 seconds, 12 seconds, then it did become clear that they probably were going to catch him. That finally happened under the kilometre kite. Florian Vermeersch had probably been the most active in that quartet. He did his last pull under the kilometre kite. He swung to the right of the road, hoping, maybe expecting, it was Jonas Abrahamsson that was in his wheel, that Abrahamsson would do a final turn, but he didn't. Shock, horror. And at that point, well, the gap to Van der Poel was 20 metres, I would say, 30 metres. Van der Poel carried on at more or less the same pace. I don't know how much he sensed, how much he knew about what was going on behind, but the quartet behind had slowed so much that 2 or 3 seconds were all it took for Van der Poel to re-establish a gap of around 50 metres and 60 metres. And almost immediately, we realised that Van der Poel was not going to be caught.
Yeah, I mean, it was an extraordinary finish. First of all, that pursuit match between Van der Poel and, I would say, four, but really Standewolf was not able to contribute much to the chase, the decathlon rider, because he'd been in that early break. Remember, Florian Vermeersch also had a mechanical problem in the early phase of the race. It hadn't been all plain sailing for him. He was there, obviously, for UAE Team Emirates. Per Strand Hagenes for Visma Lisa Bike, and Jonas Abrahamsson, I mean, who looks like a future winner of one of these races at some point, Uno X, but kind of turned down the opportunity. He and Vermeersch, you know, they had it there, didn't they? They just had to catch Van der Poel and get onto the wheel, and that would have introduced real uncertainty into that final kilometre. But I suppose neither of them wanted to be the person that rolled up onto Van der Poel's wheel and shut the door. And it was just that You even saw Van der Poel just ease up slightly. He kind of shook his legs out a bit and soft pedaled for a bit. And then when he realised they weren't on him, I mean, his senses must have been amazing. Perhaps he was listening out for heavy breathing or something. But then he just pushed on a bit, just enough, really. And the opportunity that was there, especially for the three that were fresher of those four, Vermeer, Abrahamsson and Haganes, it just slipped away. I mean, it was like the proverbial bar of soap in the bath, wasn't it? You know, it was there. All they had to do was close the grip around it and somebody would have profited and Van der Poel probably wouldn't have won. I mean, he still got a heck of a sprint, but would he have had enough against the three of them who, let's not forget, I mean, they'd been working incredibly hard to close that gap. And I think it just shows how strong Van der Poel is. But they must have had a bit more in the tank. And I think it was probably that which led to the hesitation. They all thought that basically there wasn't room to make a mistake. There wasn't room to lay it all down on the line because one mistake would cost them. And it's easy for us sitting in the armchair to think, well, one of them could have won it. They absolutely could have done. The thing was, all of them were thinking, well, this has to be me. Vermeer, she isn't going to make the crucial move to set up Abrahamsson. Abrahamsson's not going to make it to set up Haganes and so on. And I suppose looking at it as they closed in, the one move that I think you would have expected, even if he was on his last legs, you would have thought De Wolf would try something. But easy to say after an afternoon sat watching it, not easy when the legs have gone to jelly.
Yeah, I must admit, the move that I expected was an Abrahamsson counter, an Abrahamsson attack rather than a sprint. I mean, look, he's a rider that won a stage of the Tour de France last year. He beat Mauro Schmidt in a sprint in Toulouse. But we've seen him also lose small group sprints. And I maybe would have expected him to not be terribly confident in that company. But to think that maybe with a kilometre to go, we could have accelerated and done that kind of sort of finisher move. And I mean, sometimes it's a kind of a rider's body language, their demeanour on the bike, the way they ride generally. Abrahamsson, I feel like we sort of ascribe to him the, maybe without knowing him, without knowing his characteristics, obviously as well as he does, the sort of persona of the kind of slightly bloody-minded, sort of Jack Eder on. This is going way back, decades and decades. But maybe we don't think that he's necessarily the most canny rider and that it's more brawn rather than brain with him. And he was probably the rider I would have least expected to play kind of tactical games in that situation. I thought having gone to, or put in that much effort to get back to Van der Poel, there was no way that he would sacrifice the chance to win. So he would give everything at that moment, but he didn't hit him. He was sort of hedging his bets as well.
Well, I'd agree with you, Daniel, but the thing is, and this is the great alchemy of bike racing when it comes down to these moments, it was just too far. At 1.1 kilometres or a kilometre, to take a flyer from there, I think would have been just too much. If they caught Van der Poel with 600, 500 metres to go, then yes, you would have seen. Then they would have come into the catch with more momentum as well, because, you know, they had kind of eased up and they were easing up a bit. You know, it was almost like they realised they were catching him just that little bit too soon. Yes, they were going to get him, but now a kilometre, I mean, it might as well have been 10 kilometres, because there's just too much thinking time, not enough time to just hit straight away. I completely agree with you. You know, if they come in with momentum, 5, 6, even 800 metres, that probably been pushing it. But if they come in with momentum and somebody had been able to take a flyer straight away with no time to think, just react, and then put everybody else on the back foot, it could have worked. But a kilometre, I think, I'd argue, just that little bit too far to setting yourself up to lose. I mean, he lost anyway, so you could say, well, it would have been worth a try. But I think the smart move at that point was probably just to wait another few hundred meters and see if anyone else went first. And while they did that, it all slipped away from them. It was extraordinary to watch. I mean, you know, you're watching it happen quite quickly and thinking about these five different riders. They've all had different experiences through the day. They're all at different levels of fatigue. They've all got more or less to gain. Let's be honest, if Van der Poel, if it had slipped away, it's not the end of the world. He's already got two of these in the bag. His eyes are on the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, the real big ones. So in a funny way, he had absolutely nothing to lose from just seeing what happened and then giving it one last shot in that final kilometre and seeing whether it was enough. And it was. The others all stood on the cusp of a career-defining win, really. Yes, Abrahamson's won a Tour de France stage. Yes, Florian Vermeersch has won the Gravel World Championships. But to win a classic, you know, that's big stakes on the line for them. And in a funny way, is it worth to get back to the bus with a third place having lost to Van der Poel? Or is it worse getting back to the bus with a third place having lost to one of the others? It's a real sort of, it's a question for each of them, really, isn't it? But I don't think it's as simple as saying, you know, all they had to do was ... because so many, you know, mental and physical factors. And that's why we wait for these moments in cycling, I think.
I think the other thing that we have to mention is that the peloton was breathing down their neck, and that no doubt affected things as well. The peloton was led home by Tobias Lundt of Decathlon, who's having a fantastic start to the season and would be, well, fantastic again on Sunday. But that was, it was a big group as well, 20-odd or the best part of 30 riders coming in behind. So that was obviously another element to all of this.
And the other thing, Daniel, on that, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, Tobias Lund Andersen and Christophe Laporte were first and second over the line in that group. Decathlon and Visma Lisa bike, of course, had riders up the road. And then, you know, behind them was Jannie Vermeersch, no relation, of course, to Florian, but he was there with Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, who had also been very active at certain points. Jan Tratnik was doing a lot of work to kind of, you know, concertina things back up together again in that gap between when Van der Poel first went off the front. And of course, Tim van Dijk was a Red Bull rider who, you know, reacted to Sturven before Van der Poel did. So all of those different factors at play. And yeah, like you say, they could all see each other on the run-in. The peloton would certainly have been able to see the next group and probably would have seen the cars and bikes, well, not cars by that stage, but certainly the bikes accompanying Van der Poel. Yeah, a really great finish to the race. And like I say, one where you could look at the result and go, oh, Van der Poel, three in a row, so-so. But no, this was the absolute kind of sweet spot of classics racing for me.
Lionel, you mentioned Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe and their role in the chase behind the four up the front. This is maybe a conversation for later in the podcast after we've discussed Kent Fabregas and possibly even Catalunya, but I'm slightly concerned about them. I'm concerned that they're a team which doesn't really have a striker. It looks as though they're sort of playing with three false nines at the moment, and that was kind of underlined by the fact that the guy who on paper you would say is their fastest rider, their best finisher, was sort of pulling off with, I don't know whether it was about 10 kilometres to go, in the course of that chase behind Van der Poel. I'm talking about Laurens Pithy. He'd sacrificed himself when ordinarily he would have been the guy you would have expected to sprint for them. And as it panned out, Jannie Vermeersch, who is not, I mean, he's a fast enough rider, but he was their best finisher in eighth place, and they were the team, as I said, who was doing sort of most of the pursuing, most of the chasing behind the four up front.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, Jan Tratnik is kind of the diesel to get in amongst it, isn't he? And he was kind of used in that earlier phase. And once Van der Poel had gone, you know, arguably the race had kind of flown by that stage, and they weren't really, well, they weren't in it, were they? They were then playing catch up. Whereas, you know, UAE and Visma Lisa Bike both had riders in the break. Red Bull were kind of caught between two stools, weren't they? They did do a lot of chasing, and they certainly played a key role in bringing it all back together. But from their point of view, to what ends?
Yeah,
you're absolutely right.
They're riding like a big team. They are a big team with a big budget, but they don't really have a big leader. And, well, we'll see that again in Kent Faber. And another...
Sort of doing cycling by numbers, weren't they? What do we do if we've kind of missed a break? Well, you have to do this now. And they did that, and they did it quite well. But, yeah, no end result.
Another wannabe super team, probably deserve the title of super team nowadays, who didn't have the best day. Little Trek, I think a lot of people saw the way Mats Pedersen performed in Milan-San Remo after his big layoff, and that very fast and impressive recovery after he broke his wrist in Valencia, wasn't it, in February. And they assumed that we would get the best version of Mats Pedersen in the Cold Classics. We may yet get that, but it occurred to me watching E3 that is a very different challenge to Milan-San Remo. We've talked a lot about the relative simplicity of Milan-San Remo as compared with the hundreds of accelerations you have to do in a race like E3 or Tour of Flanders. And Pedersen, I mean, he tried his best, but he'd missed the move on the Tyrannberg and eventually finished ninth, very creditable. We expected him, obviously he was going for his fourth win in Gent-Wevelgem, we expected him to be good there, but he would miss Gent-Wevelgem because he was sick on Sunday, so he had to pull out. Should we move on to Gent-Wevelgem?
It's a tough one though, yeah, but very quickly though, it's a tough one this, because it's 208 kilometres, which it basically loses the sort of 60 kilometres, which is the sort of the wearing down, the sort of deadening, the thing that brings the real top class riders, you know, all to the fore, doesn't it? I mean, and I think having missed that move, it's then a kind of condensed version of the Tour of Flanders, the mini Tour of Flanders as they nickname it, and so less opportunity I felt for Pedersen to get back on terms once the move had gone, especially with kind of all the traffic in the way. But it was a good result, and then I do, you know, I'm not doubting that he's ill. You know, it may well be, there's a lot of it going around at the moment, and we haven't even ridden any World Tour races yet this year, Daniel. But it's one of those, isn't it? You never quite know at this stage of the season, you know, is it, look, he's done enough, you know, he's had enough of a kind of workout, he's gone into the red a bit too much maybe in E3. Again, he's coming off the back of having won Gent-Wevelgem a couple of times in a row. So does he need a third, or does he need to just, sorry, a fourth? Yes, of course, because he's, yeah, does he need a fourth? Yeah, so, you know, the big one on Sunday, is it just a case of just take it easy for a week, relatively speaking, and just make sure that he's in the best shape possible for Sunday morning? We'll wait and see. Just lastly, did you see the social media clip? The supporters who filmed Axel Zingel of Visma Lisa Bike taking an absolute flyer
in a car
in no man's land off the car handle. He got disqualified the Visma Lisa Bike rider.
A car driven by not one of their regular direct supporters, but their team manager, Richard Plugger, because he was the gentleman that got the yellow card, which is not a good look at all. Is it?
For the team boss?
No.
I mean, I know I've said in the past about this sort of vigilante justice and it not necessarily, because, you know, it's selective, isn't it? Have fans filmed a misdemeanour or not? You know, that could equally have gone unseen and unpunished. But I actually think in the case of most egregious or anything that's so blatant, you know, if the race organisers and the jury have got access to footage which shows, you know, something that is beyond the pale, really, it's not just coming back up through the cars or holding a bottle for a bit longer than is necessary. It was cheating, yeah, basically.
And then Lionel, so we got the Visma Lisa Bike statement about that sort of apology, and then fast forward a few hours, and we got a statement by Visma Lisa Bike about something that happened in another race that was going on at the weekend, the Settimana Coppa Bartali, Italian stage race. Talking, and at that stage we hadn't seen the video, but talking about how a couple of drunk fans had supposedly climbed on top of the car and tried to untether a bicycle steal a bike, and I wondered at that point whether this wasn't deflection, but then video evidence did emerge and it was quite a serious incident. Incidentally, just on that, the version that's been reported in the Italian press, local press, I mean, there's a bit of sort of sniggering, there has been a bit of sniggering about this because they're in Prosecco country, so they're in the Veneto, near Val d'Obbiana, famous for its Prosecco. And that region of Italy is famous, infamous, comedically, for one thing, and that is the amount that people drink. And whether these fans were drunk or not is a bit of a moot point. But one thing that the eyewitnesses did say was that bottles had been thrown out of team car windows, possibly the Visma Lisa bike team car window, and that had hit a vehicle belonging to these two gentlemen who subsequently retaliated by trying to get a bike off the top of the car.
Goodness me, Daniel, you've been working in the media too long if you thought that this was some kind of treble bluff by the Visma Lisa bike media team to deflect away from Axel Zingel's misdemeanor. I can't remember who I need to give credit to for this one, but it did tickle me on social media, somebody referring to this incident. Come on, guys, it's Visma Lisa bike, not Visma Steeler bike.
So, Lionel, that was E3 on Friday. Fast forward 2 days to Gent-Wevelgem, and very different race, a longer race. Similar scenario in the sense that, as far as I was sort of concerned, Lionel, the race opened up at a similar point in the sense that it was with sort of 80 kilometres to go, as had been the case with E3. In E3, we've seen Jasper Stuyven attacking on the Tyrenberg, in Gent-Wevelgem on the plug streets. So this section of gravel roads, pretty flat gravel roads, aren't they? Line of flattish, often exposed to the wind. And we saw the race really breaking apart there. And Stuyven was certainly one of several riders who at various points were trying to split things. We saw Christophe Laporte talking about Visma Lisa, but we also saw Sturven's teammate, Sudar Quickstep teammate, Paul Manier, who had a very unlucky day, another unlucky day, trying to split things. But really that signified the start of the serious business, the plug streets, didn't it, Lionel?
Yeah, I really like this course now. The little cluster of hills, the Kemmelberg, going up the old-fashioned way, if you like, the nice, attractive, cobbly way. Then the plug streets, and then the cluster of hills again. And then this kind of long, drawn-out finale from the final climb to the finish. And when the wind blows the way it did on Sunday, it can make for really good racing, which I felt it did. Again, it was another great race to watch. The wind was just enough, wasn't it? It kind of caused havoc. The invisible enemy on days like that, when you see the riders across the road and it's splitting and but it's not absolutely cut to ribbons. And I think echelon racing, when it's like that, and especially with a route that twists and turns the way it does, it really takes its toll on the riders and makes it hard. And, well, once again, it was Mathieu van der Poel who kind of lit it all up again, wasn't it? And I was surprised slightly that he decided to start after the day he had on Friday, and with the Tour of Flanders still to come, he could have done a, you know, I've done enough, I'll have the Sunday off, but he didn't. And not only did he not take the opportunity to rest his legs, but he got out there again. It was a fascinating watch. You mentioned Paul Manier. I mean, he had a front wheel puncture, didn't he? And he had to swap his bike. He took Bert van Leerberger's bike, and then he got another bike from the team car. And then just when he needed some help to sort of get back up, Yves Lampaert had a problem as well. And so it took them a while to, I think it was 10, 15 kilometres before the Manier group got back up to the front. And by that time, they were coming back up to the Kemmelberg again. The early break was now only sort of 25, 30 seconds clear. And the Kemmelberg is one of those where, you know, it starts off, everyone's all together, and just gradually, the cream rises to the top. And as we saw, it was Wout van Aert, Mathieu van der Poel, and Florian Vermeersch, who got away and joined the remnants of the break, which was coming back at them. And from there, well, it looked like it was going to be a sort of repeat of the 2020 Tour of Flanders, the sort of autumn Tour of Flanders, if you remember, when it was Van der Poel and Van Aert going all the way to the line. I thought that would be how it would pan out, but the gap never really got big enough to rule out the groups behind, and there were enough bodies behind to make it interesting. Again, another fascinating watch as they came into the Kemmel the last time. That was where Vermeersch was kind of hanging on a bit and then got dropped. Van Aert had to dig really deep. You know, his head was bobbing side to side to hang on to the wheel of Matthew van der Poel. And yeah, then we had another sort of barnstorming final 30k. Yeah.
We had, you mentioned there, the last time at the Kemmels, that's with around 35 kilometres to go. Van der Poel went over a second, 2 seconds ahead of Van Aert, but Van Aert was able to get back on. Vermeersch was a few more seconds behind, and he didn't manage to get back on. He was sort of caught in no man's land about 15 seconds from that duo for several kilometres, wasn't it? And was really doomed in that position. And yeah, as you said, we had this fantastic pursuit. Van Aert and Matthew van der Poel, sort of the George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley reuniting at the front of the race. And well, they stayed out there. It was those two with a shrinking gap until, well, inside the last 5 kilometres. We saw Ineos with Filippo Ganna, particularly on the front, trying to reel them back in. And then just as they were getting very close to peloton, a few seconds away, Alex Sager of Bahrain Victorious bridged himself. It was a gap of around 100, 200 metres at that point, but he bridged himself. So just inside the last 5 kilometres, we had Sager, Van Aert and Van der Poel just a few seconds ahead of the peloton.
Yeah, and Sager's got form, hasn't he? Because he was in the thick of the action at the Nocur de Corsa recently, and he won the Grand Prix de Nam, which is cobbly racing, sort of quasi Paris-Roubaix country. And he rode across pretty well, didn't he? But then a horrible conundrum once he'd reached Van der Poel and Van Aert. Well, now what? Now what? Again, it was, you know, it was just too far to, well, it was far too far to go from that point. But he was sort of stuck then, wasn't he?
Yeah.
What do I do?
I have seen some suggestion as well that this is also what scuppered, I'm not sure I subscribe to this, that this is also what scuppered Van der Poel and Van Aert, in the sense that as soon as the third man came across, they were wary of him. They were worried about what he might do in a sprint, and they took their foot off the gas a little bit. Zooming out, there has also been the suggestion, I think backed up by what Van der Poel has said, that he was holding back generally a little bit, because of course he had Philipsen behind. Van Aert thought that he was holding, that Van der Poel was maybe holding back a little bit. He was tired, of course, after E3. And Lionel, you mentioned that he might have thought about skipping E3. Of course, one thing we should remember is that of all the races, and they've won all of them, all of the sort of Belgian one-day races at the start of the season, this was the one that Alpecin had not yet won, Alpecin Premier Tech. Maybe another reason why he did decide to line up on Sunday.
Yeah, you gave a bit of credit there to Filippo Ganna of Ineos Grenadiers, because, I mean, his turn on the front was absolutely monstrous.
The Italians were up in arms. Why is he pulling for this English schmuck, Sam Watson?
Sam Watson, unfortunately, rewarded Ganna and the team with 17th place. So, you know, the results bear out that criticism somewhat. But again, somebody had to close it down close enough to do anything, didn't they? There were quite a few teams with riders in there. Red Bull, again, rode very hard. They had Jordi Meus as their man. Decathlon were doing a bit. They had Lund Andersen, of course. NSN, I thought, possibly could have done a bit more with Biniam Gamai.
Biniam looked spent in the sprint, didn't he? He looked absolutely done, yeah.
True enough. And, you know, Alpecin Premier Tech and Visma Lisa bike once again in the sort of, you know, the luxury position, you know, coasting to the finish in armchairs, really, because they've got the two riders up the road. Yes, Alex Segert, you know, introduced a little bit of uncertainty into the finale up there, but Philipson and Laporte especially could sort of sit there and wait and see how this played out. Segert did try and go for one, didn't he? Sort of kilometre and a bit from the line, but he was caught, what, 400-500 metres from the line as the sprint was engulfing him. Van der Poel and Van Aert had been caught before then. And yeah, as you say, Jasper Philipsen, who's been looking better and better. I said a couple of weeks ago before Milan-San Remo that, you know, not as hot as he has looked at this time of year, but he's been getting better and, you know, at least got a win under his belt at Nokia, of course. Okay, not the same level as this. And he was perhaps surprisingly beaten by Groenewegen. I don't know whether that's a surprise beating, because Groenewegen is quick, but beaten into second place at the Ronde van Brugge. But no mistakes here. A good sprint ahead of Tobias Lund Andersen, whose results are looking impressive. And then Christophe Laporte in third place. And like I say, You look at the way it's panned out for Alpecin Premier Tech there, and it absolutely worked perfectly for them. You know, all of that uncertainty of the fact that Van der Poel was getting caught, and yet they still come away with first place. So worked out brilliantly for them. And when you look at the World Tour results so far this season, Daniel, I don't know whether you sort of noticed the pattern when you look through. If you take it from the UAE Tour through to now, and I'm not discounting the two Australian races, but this block of the season, the World Tour stage races and one-day races have been won by Del Toro, Van der Poel, Pogacar, Vingegaard, Del Toro, Pogacar, Vingegaard, Groenewegen, Van der Poel, and then Philipsen. I mean, we're talking about a real concentration on a handful of teams and riders here, aren't we? It's quite an extraordinary era that we're living through. And I think it just shows that the stakes are so high, the best riders have to deliver at every possible opportunity. And they are doing that.
Yes. A couple of things to say. Alpecin Premier Tech, I mean, they on paper didn't look as though they had the strongest team, and they haven't. Well, they've maybe looked to some people as though they're not looking as strong in their sort of backroom department this year. They've lost a couple of riders, the likes of Killick and a couple of others. They had Seneschal riding, and Philipsen referenced his lead out, his work in the lead out, and the fact that they're kind of unfamiliar with each other at the moment, but certainly did the job at the weekend. Jonas Haynes as well, riding for Alpecin Premier Tech, he's just joined them, and again kind of unfamiliar, so they have, well, they've completed the set now of these Belgian races. But you talk about sort of individuals, I suppose, versus the great Galacticos that have distinguished this era versus maybe the teams with collective strength. And you know, I think of Sudal Quickstep, things haven't really turned for them yet, and they've come into this year with a sort of different approach, refocused on the classics, but on paper looking as though they've got a very strong team with the likes of Sturven, Van Baarle, Manier, but it hasn't really worked for them yet. And I mentioned Red Bull, Bora Hansgrohe as well, looking really strong collectively, but without the guy to sort of bring it home in the end.
Yeah, I have to give a nod as well to Unibet Rose Rockets, because they got two riders in that break, Hartijs de Vries and Wessel Muris. And, well, when it all broke down and there was only, what, four of them left, they were still there. And they rode extremely well again, really showing what can be done up against the might of the big teams. But you're right, it's kind of like freelancer's heaven in the next places, wasn't it? You know, Arnaud Delis of Antimarché, Robert Donaldson of Jayco, a couple of Tudor riders in the top seven, Matteo Trentin and Luca Mazzato, and Aimé de Gendt of Pinarello Q36.5, I think had a go at some point at riding across to the break, didn't he, after the Bannerberg, and didn't make it, got stuck in no man's land, and probably quite happy to get a place in the top 10.
Lionel, one other thing I forgot to mention just about the lead out. There was some suggestion that Case Bollard did a bit of a naive lead out in the sense that he'd let Philipson and let the Alpecin train in on the barriers on his left-hand side. I mean, Decathlon, another team that as a unit, collectively, they've been impressive throughout the season, and they're in the classics and also in stage races. We'll talk later about Catalunya, maybe mention likes of Felix Gall. We've got deep into this episode focusing on Belgian classics without Lionel making our obligatory time-honoured turn to Corvett's Corner. Should we do that now?
Absolutely.
Pay attention, Freebie. What did we learn from the past weekend? A lot, and at the same time, not much. Although we certainly got two exciting finals. Harold Baker seemed like a modern version of the comedy capers. You can fill in the blanks yourself as to who Laurel and Hardy and the others were. I couldn't get my head around the fact that absolutely none of the four pursuers wanted to put in a few more pedal strokes to catch up with Van der Poel. Ex-pros explained to me that this happens often, and even frequently in new phrasing. I have never raced myself, so I don't understand it. While Harelbeke was much more exciting towards the end than in other years, on Sunday we got a very typical Gent Wevelgem. The hunger of the many fans was satisfied with even 3/4 of an hour of Van der Poel and Van Aert riding a Trofeo Barrecchi, but in the end, Jasper Philipsen won the group sprint. And then we come to the conclusion of the weekend. In no time, Alpecin Premier Tech has taken over Quickstep's role. Not so long ago, Patrick Lefevre was the godfather of the cobbled classics. That role is now held by brothers Philippe and Christophe Roodhoofd, who, with Mathieu van der Poel and Jasper Philipsen, not only have a golden duo, but also dominate the two previous classics with surprising ease. Have we discovered new names? Yes, Florian Vermeers is the man closest to the big four. He was the man who rolled out the red carpet for Mathieu van der Poel in the Omloop Nieuwsblad, and was the jet engine on Friday that pushed MVDB to the limit. On Sunday, he fell just short. But it is mainly good news for Pogačar, who will have followed everything from his lazy armchair in Monaco. Van der Poel, Pedersen and Van Aert do not have such a rocket launcher at their disposal for the Ronde van Vlaanderen. Unless it is Per Strand Hagenes, a Norwegian who, together with Jonas Abrahamsen, is trying to be the successor to Alexander Kristoff and the Flemish cobbled classics. Then there are also Stan de Wulf and Alex Seyhaert, who taught the entire peloton a lot. Even with the presence of the big four, a man with a more than average engine can make a bid for a podium spot in the Ronde van Vlaanderen. Van Aert is ready to play just in time. The question mark we put behind Wout for Milan-Sanremo moves to Mats Pedersen. Just like Van Aert, he's holding a dress rehearsal at Dwars door Vlaanderen in Waregem. We can summarize the Ronde van Vlaanderen in 3 sentences. Either Van Aert or Pedersen have achieved their dream, or Pogačar will know on Sunday evening if he can continue his raid on the 5 monuments in 1 season. Or Mathieu van der Poel, as the Flying Dutchman, will make history by becoming the very first ever to win the Ronde van Vlaanderen 4 times. Stay tuned for Easter Sunday around 4:30 p.m. Belgian time.
Studies show that 100% of everybody in the world wants to curl up indoors and do nothing because it's so darn cold out there. That's why many people are turning to Bombas, whose pillowy plush slippers and warm merino wool socks have been said to be the most comfortable in the history of feet. Bombas products have been found to boost coziness by up to 1,000,000%. Okay, enough fake statistics, but could Bombas socks and slippers really be the cure? Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code AUDIO.
Well, Lionel, of course, we've got one more cobbled race before the Tour of Flanders at the weekend. We've got Dwarsdorf-Vlaanderen on Wednesday. Have we got a good start list for that yet?
Not quite, but on a provisional start list, Mads Pedersen is on there for Little Trek, so maybe he's feeling better. Maybe this is
also
better.
Philipsen is on the start list for that, and he's not doing the Tour of Flanders, which is interesting. One other thing I wanted to mention earlier, just when we were talking about Florian Vermeersch, is that I suppose there was extra jeopardy for him in E3, and there has been in all of the races to date, and there will be in Dwarsdorf-Vlaanderen on Wednesday, because of course he knows that Pogacar's arrival is imminent, and presumably you would think, even at Paris-Roubaix, that Pogacar, in terms of superiority, he would be the UAE leader.
Well, you would have thought
yes. So Vermeersch might be back on domestic duty pretty soon. Domestic deluxe, I would suggest. Lionel, a couple of other things.
Maybe spare him decision making just for the, you know, let somebody else do that.
Lionel, just looking ahead to Tour of Flanders at the weekend, obviously Belgian fans will have been very excited by Wout van Aert's return to prominence and him looking very good, and of course he's had his injury problems with that broken ankle, wasn't it, in the cyclocross race in Mol, if I'm not mistaken, hometown of Jasper Philipsen a few weeks ago, but he's had his problems, but he's obviously back to decent fitness. We saw that at Milan San Remo as well. However, I hate to burst some bubbles, but the last ascent of the Kemmel yesterday with a relatively tired by his own admission, Mathieu van der Poel, a couple of seconds ahead of Van Aert, it suggested to me that expectations need to be managed a little bit as far as Van Aert is concerned.
Yeah, especially, the Kemmelberg's hard, isn't it? But it's not the Paterberg, it's not the Koppenberg, is it? It's not as steep. A little bit. But there's still some days to go, isn't there? And the Tour of Flanders, the introduction of Tadej Pogacar will change the race. It just will, won't it? I mean, everyone will be expecting him to open it up, and he'll be a man to watch. It's about reacting to that, I guess, and then hoping that there's some kind of thrilling finale that Van Aert can be a part of. And then once it comes down to just kind of racing, you give him a chance. But the problem is that it's when, I mean, and you see it with Van der Poel, you know, there's just a moment, isn't there, when he just turns on the gas that little bit more that no one else can live with on those steep cobbled climbs. And really, he and Pogacar, although very different size and shape of rider, you know, slightly different skills and strength, the two of them are pretty well matched on those climbs, I would say. You know, maybe on something like the Quaremont, Van der Poel has an edge. Maybe on the real steep ones, Pogacar has an edge.
Although it's generally been on the Quaremont in the last few years when Pogacar has dispensed with Van der Poel, because obviously it's by far the longest climb, isn't it, in the Tour of Flanders. It's a couple of kilometres, what is it, 5 minute effort, something like that.
Quite. So, yeah, they're very well matched, those two, and anyone else who wants to be a feature in the finale needs to react to one or other of them. When they go, because that will be the moment, won't it? So it'll be interesting. The whole of Belgium will be hoping that when it opens up, Van Aert is there, and the first victory for Van Aert on Sunday will be to get himself into a group like that. And I do wonder, I think, you know, the other teams have got to start thinking slightly differently about how they try and beat Van der Poel and Pogacar, because I think we are seeing a slow evolution of this. You know, the early breaks are getting stronger. that, you know, generally as a sometimes, you know,
the problem. Yeah, the problem with that, the only effect that that's having is making the faster the start of the race is faster, and that all feeds into Pogacar reasserting his superiority.
True enough, but if you know you're getting to the point where a Sudal Quickstep or a Red Bull or a Hansgrohe has to start thinking, look, we maybe need somebody up the road early who can then help a bit more, you know, in that middle phase of the race.
So we've got some, but
this is me, armchair sports director. Who's going to let a Sudal Quickstep or a Red Bull or a Hansgrohe rider just sort of, you know, toddle off the front in the opening half an hour of the Tour of Flanders? It's just a real conundrum for everybody else. And as you say, Daniel, that you could write it now and probably get pretty close to, you know, to pinning down what will happen on Sunday. Let's face it. You know, E3 played out exactly as we expected, really. It was just the finale was so gripping that it introduced that sense of, you know, drama and suspense. But if Van der Poel had got another 20 seconds in that key phase, he would have just ridden, you know, 70k to the finish again. And so, yeah, it's going to be really interesting. But again, that's what makes the real big, tough races. You know, even when they're you know, a little bit prosaic, perhaps they still unmissable.
Lionel, I vastly, vastly, egregiously underestimated Tadej Pogacar's climbing prowess. I said that Faramond might be a 5-minute effort. It's 2:49. His record. It'd take me 5 minutes on a good day, probably.
On foot.
Yeah. The other thing I was just going to say, Lionel, about the, you know, we've talked a lot in the last few weeks about how the races start much faster than they once did, and we've sort of spoken as though that's purely a tactical thing, and that's just a decision that teams like UAE are taking. But I think if you bear in mind what we've heard over the last few years about the way team cars interact with their riders, and particularly we've had this conversation particularly about safety and things like, you know, VeloViewer. All of the teams are on VeloViewer, of course, and they're all of the directors are picking out dangerous points of the race, and they're communicating with their riders more and more and more. And in a race like the Tour of Flanders, where there is so much to bear in mind, as compared with Milan-San Remo, there are sort of five key points in Milan-San Remo. Everyone knows where they are. Everyone has got the profile of Milan-San Remo sort of saved on their internal hard drive. The Tour of Flanders, you can do it for years and years and still not know. Most of the riders in the race at the weekend won't know what the climbs are called. They won't know whether they're turning left or right at the top, because it's a maze. And what does that mean? Well, the directors in the cars behind are probably constantly chirping at their riders, and that message is generally always the same: get to the front, go faster. And that lends itself to a fast start of the race, fast first 2, 3, 4 hours, and again, that makes it even more likely that the cream is going to rise to the top, and it's going to be Pogacar and it's going to be Van der Poel, and it becomes inevitable, it becomes unavoidable.
Yeah, and I think also we saw this perhaps most keenly on Sunday, Gent-Wevelgem in Flanders Field. Sorry, we're going to have to start paying a euro fine each time we get a race name wrong. The wind.
Maybe the organisers should pay a euro fine to us every time they change the bloody name.
The wind that split it all up, and you know, then it's in groups, and then the cars can't get through, and then suddenly luck becomes a premium. You know, Manier, that was poor luck for him. You know, he had a problem at a time when the cars were nowhere near, and you know, it was quite a wait to get himself a bike. You know, the sort of unpredictableness, you know, you being in that middle bit of the peloton, you might as well be just sort of a, you know, country mile away from the front. And so you're right, the tension ramps up earlier and earlier in these races. And it will be interesting on the rollout just to see, you know, who gets let go, whether it's another kind of, you know, just a nice break that's got some of the smaller teams in. It'll be a, you know, a relatively small size, won't it? I don't think they'll let anything unpredictable go. And so it becomes very difficult to see how do you beat Van der Poel and Pogacar. You know, what's the alternative? Go a bit earlier. I mean, if the only way to beat somebody who can go 50-60k from the finishes to go 70-80k from the finish, you're talking about, you know, almost nobody can do that. So nevertheless, it will be interesting to see you know, how they try and solve this puzzle again. Well, Daniel, we'll be back on Sunday for the next episode of Arrivé, talking about the Tour of Flanders. Rose Manley will be back as well. Not sure who's joining Rose for analysis of the Women's Tour of Flanders. Before we move on and head to Catalonia in Spain, the women's races over the last few days. The Ronde van Brugge was won by a young British rider, 19-year-old, riding for Movistar, not Kat Ferguson, Caris Lloyd. Excellent win for her there. And in Flanders Fields, Wevelgem to Wevelgem, Lorena Wiebes of SD Works won there for the third year in a row. So that's a record, I believe, in the women's race. The next episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminam will be dropping fairly soon as well. I think it's between the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, but not 100% sure on that at the moment.
Lionel, stage races now. Stage races that have already happened. Settimana Internazionale Coppia Bartali, already mentioned the drunken, allegedly, possibly drunken antics of two fans. It was a very good week for Team Jacob Alula. Mauro Schmidt of Switzerland took the GC. He also won the final stage. It was a good week as well for Axel Laurence of Ineos Grenadiers. He took two stage wins and second on the final stage. I should also mention Jaco got third place on the final podium as well with Alan Hathaway, the former mountain biker, South African rider. That was Coppie Bartali. On the other side of the Mediterranean, not far from where I am currently actually, was the Volta a Catalunya World Tour race, of course, hotly anticipated. I think we'd already, Larry and I had already started discussing this last week because it had already started. At that point, we were expecting a big battle between Jonas Vingegaard and Remco Evenepoel. They weren't the only two big hitters on the start list, but we certainly expected them to duel over the weekend, and it was a bit of a mismatch really, because Jonas Vingegaard was the very convincing winner in the end of the Volta a Catalunya. Two stage wins, he won two big mountain stages on stage 5 and stage 6. This was after what should have been the previous mountain stage, which was stage 4, that was truncated because of snow up in the Pyrenees. Lionel,
was it not high Vingegaard, winds? Was it not high winds again?
I think it was. I think you were right. I did see some pictures of snow, but I think high winds was the actual reason. I'm going to give the GC and then we'll dive into what actually happened, who was hot and who was not, Lionel. The final GC, well, Jonas Vingegaard, I said he was the GC winner. 1 minute and 22 seconds he finished ahead of Lenny Martinez of Bahrain Victorious. Very good week for him. And in third place was a Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe rider, but it was not Remco Evenepoel. It was Florian Lipovits, who was 1 minute and 30 seconds behind Vingegaard. I'm going to go down the GC. Fourth, Valentin Paris-Peintre of Quickstep, of Sudal Quickstep. And fifth, Remco Evenepoel of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. 2 minutes, 13 down. Felix Gall was sixth. Schelmoser of Little Trek was seventh. Utebrooks eighth. Riccitello ninth. And Carapaz 10th. Now, Lionel, as I said, we were sort of expecting, I don't know where Remco's at sort of publicly in his public utterances about the Tour de France, but a sort of amuse-bouche ahead of what we might see later at the Tour de France between Remco Evenepoel and Jonas Vingegaard. Of course, Tadej Pogacar will be there as well. But we do expect Vingegaard and Remco to be among the protagonists, and both of them going for the yellow jersey at the Tour de France. And it was very one-sided. Vingegaard simply rode away from everyone on the two key mountain stages. Of course, we'd had that really exciting moment earlier in the week, stage 3, when the wind was blowing and the race split up into echelons, and Remco simply rode right off the front into the open road, and I think it was about 30 kilometers to go, and Vingegaard was the only one who could follow him, and it looked as though those two were riding into the finish on their own, untroubled, but they came to a roundabout and Remco then crashed. He didn't seem to be too badly affected. Were his performances later in the week badly affected? We're not really sure. The fact was that Remco then sort of subordinated his own GC ambitions to those of his teammate Florian Lipovits, and actually did quite a lot of riding for Lipovits on the next 2 days. But another World Tour stage race in which I suppose Remco's final result doesn't really flatter him.
No, I mean, he hit a pothole, didn't he, approaching that roundabout in the last kilometre. It had been a fairly uneasy alliance with Vingegaard, really, hadn't it? I mean, Vingegaard was kind of sitting on a bit, as is his right. Remco gestured at least once for Vingegaard to come through. He kind of said something similar, I'm going to misquote here, but it's sort of, the inference was that, you know, Vingegaard was unplayable, you know, in that he wasn't going to blink. And he was caught, and who won the stage there? It was Dorian Godon, wasn't it, who won again, making it 2 wins out of 3 for him at that stage for Ineos Grenadiers. Just on Dorian Godon, I must admit, that's a surprising transfer, I felt, Godon to Ineos from Decathlon. I wondered what they saw in him, I must admit, but he's really done well this season.
Maybe they've been listening to the cycling podcast, and they've been hearing Larry rave about how powerful he is for several years. But honestly, I think that is a bit of an open secret in the peloton how talented this guy is and has been. I mean, his early years, for example, when he was at Cofidis, he was still studying part-time, and it was felt that the day when he finally stopped studying and was able to dedicate all of his energies to his cycling, he would thrive. And the last couple of years, I mean, he has been a horse for a particular kind of course, sort of uphill sprint, but he seems now to be gaining confidence. I mean, I saw some quotes from him this morning to the effect that he thought he could have won 5 stages in Catalonia in the end, but he seems to be sort of growing into the role and the idea that he might even be a kind of bunch sprinter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not that he hasn't won races. He has won races, some very big ones. He won Brabantse-Pale in 2023. He's won a couple of stages of the Tour of Romandy, but kind of the sorts of wins that we sometimes see riders when they're basically outnumbered by, you know, Paris-Camembert, stages of the Tour du Poitou-Charentes, or the Tour de Vendée, you know, these kind of races, it almost kind of overshadows the level of the bigger wins.
Tippy-tappy,
a little bit tippy-tappy, yeah. But I think we saw at Paris-Nice just what a quality rider he is, a finisher for certain types of terrain, and a real kind of broad sense of terrain as well. You know, it gives the Ineos Grenadiers quite a lot of options on quite a range of different races, different stages within stage races. I thought the way he won the opening stage was, you talked about it with Larry last week, but you know, he's got the timing right, the strength right, everything about it right. Same again on stage 3. But the original point, Daniel, about Remco Evenepoel, I mean, he did, you know, kind of accept that subordinate role and did a lot of work for Lipovits quite happily, and Lipovits got a decent result. But pretty ominous, Vingegaard, who, I know, maybe we've been listening to Brian Nygaard a little bit, you know, and hearing the sort of sense, and it's a sense I've had as well, he doesn't look like a man who absolutely loves the races, you know. Sometimes it looks almost like a sort of, you know, a reluctant hero, a sense of perhaps a little bit of obligation. But he's come out of the gate very fast this year. He won Paris-Nice, you know, almost unopposed, really. Good every day. And again, he was good every day. And we talked about this in, you know, last year, and I think the Critérium du Dauphiné, when, you know, he has actually got a real racing nose, a real racing instinct at times. And he's a big enough profile that he won't blink and get kind of bullied into cooperating with Evenepoel on a flat run-in if he doesn't want to. You know, he's got that kind of gravitas about him. Maybe doesn't wear it as emphatically or flamboyantly as others, but it was a solid, solid week. And to go into the Giro d'Italia, which is not that far away now, is it 5 weeks, I think, with two World Tour stage race wins and all of the stages that he collected on the way, he couldn't have had a better start to the season.
No, I think he showed us once again that there is, if we think about the hierarchy of Grand Tour riders and climbers in the peloton, there is maybe Pogacar in his own tier, and then there is Vingegaard, who's still very much in his own tier, and then there is definitely the rest. There's quite a gap, I feel, to the rest. And again, to go back to the point I was making when we were talking about the cobbled races, about Red Bull, Bora Hansgrohe, I'd be slightly concerned if I were them on... having watched Catalunya, on the face of it, a pretty decent week with Lipovic finishing third, but he looked a lot like he did at the Tour de France last year. A diesel who is going to be very consistent and is going to be very robust, but I'm not sure he's ever going to be able to bridge the gap to those, well, A tier and sort of B tiers, Pogacar, Vingegaard, and then you've got Remco. And if you think of the amount of money that Red Bull, Bora Hansgrohe have invested in those two, and again, the amount of money that they've invested in their classics team, I just hope that they don't become a bit of a blunt instrument.
I think it does increase the pressure a bit on Evenepoel for the Amstel Gold Race, Flèche-Wallonne, Liège-Bastogne-Liège coming up towards the end of April. You know, there's three... sort of one-shot deals for him to deliver something significant before the build-up to the Tour de France and the Critérium du Dauphiné Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes, I think, isn't it? Rhône-Alpes. Oh, God, I'm mangling the name. I'm just going to call it the Dauphiné until further notice. And then the Tour de France where, yeah, he really... The ceiling does look like, you know, making the third step on the podium in the Tour de France would be a big step for him. So, the pressure ramps up a bit on Remco Evenepoel. But having said that, it's to his credit that, you know, after having the crash and, you know, obviously not the legs, he didn't go hiding. You know, he didn't go missing for the team. He did a good, solid job for the rest of the race.
Lionel, we should also just mention a couple of stage wins for the home team, I suppose, because their team manager, Chil Karlström, early in the year, did tell me that it's a team with Catalan DNA. NSN Cycling, they had two stage wins in Catalunya, one through Ethan Vernon and one, a surprising one, yesterday in Barcelona from Brady Gilmore. Ahead of Godon, so it was a very good week for them, I would suggest, and very good week as well for Lenny Martinez, who's had an excellent start to the season. Again, a guy who to me doesn't look as though, although he's 22, and this occurred to me this morning thinking about this, that rewind 10 years or so, and if you laid out Lenny Martinez's results and said this is a 22-year-old rider, you would have thought the sky is the absolute limit for a guy like this. I don't necessarily look at Lenny Martinez, even when I see him riding and see him performing the way he is at the moment, I don't necessarily think that when I see Lenny Martinez. I don't think he's going to win a Tour de France at any point soon, but nonetheless had a fantastic start to the season. Another man, Lionel, who was broken, who has smashed the 1,000 UCI point barrier already this season. Stage win in Paris-Nice, of course, and fifth in general classification there, and second in general classification in Catalunya. So I actually thought that Bahrain would really struggle this year. I looked at their recruitment and I looked at some of the riders they'd lost, and I saw a team that was maybe struggling to locate its identity, and I thought that it might be a rough year because that had been the trajectory of that team, to be honest, for a year or two. But between Sega, Martinez and a couple of others, they've started pretty well.
They have. I mean, pound for pound or kilogram to point, Lenny Martinez must be the most efficient rider in the world. I think he's only about 52 kilos. A few other people to mention, though, Daniel. Tom Pidcock had a bad crash on a descent towards the end of stage five, didn't he? He had looked pretty good on the first stage, perhaps mistimed his sprint slightly, but had Milan San Remo in his legs, of course. Catalunya started only 2 days after Milan San Remo, but Pidcock's crash ruled him out of the rest of the race. He's injured his wrist and right knee. He said that he was taking a drink on the descent and ran off the road. So we await his return. I mean, the next big objectives for Pidcock will be what, Daniel? It will be Brabantse Pale, and then Amstel, Fleschwell, and Liège, Bastogne, Liège. So plenty of time to rest up and heal up. When you were running down the GC, I wondered how far you were going to go. We could have been here all day looking for João Almeida of UAE Team Emirates, who had a real rough week, considering he is going to be leading UAE Team Emirates in their attempts to unseat the hot favourite, Jonas Vingegaard, at the Giro d'Italia. Not the best week for Almeida. Where was he? He was 38th overall.
Yeah.
20-odd minutes down.
It hasn't been, Pogacar aside, it hasn't been the best period. I mean, by the extremely severe measure of last year, it hasn't been the best couple of weeks, just in terms of tangible results. Obviously, Florian Vermeersch was very good at the weekend, but didn't really have anything to show for it. And Pogacar aside, they've struggled in the last period to pick up the wins.
Yeah, considering, I mean, smaller races, aren't they? Valenciana, Almeida was second, and Algarve, he was third. But yeah, real sort of, you know, off target at Catalunya. And he is not due to race again until the Giro. So he will go into the Giro, if that's how it stays, he'll go into the Giro somewhat uncertain quantity, won't he? The other riders I just wanted to mention, stage six, the penultimate day, one of the tough uphill finishes. You know, we saw riders sort of stretching and faltering. Onley, Oot de Brooks, you know, slightly, a little bit more disappointing than I would have anticipated. And the other thing, Daniel, we've talked about it before, but I do love that final stage in Barcelona, the climb up and over Montjuïc. It's a kind of foreshadow of where we'll be for the Tour de France in July. It was made more interesting, exciting by the wind blowing a bit, breaking things up. But the sprint was, I mean, real kind of seat of the pants stuff, wasn't it? I'm sort of wincing slightly at the pace they come round that sort of sweeping bend into the finishing straight. It's quite wide. It just looks real kind of seat to the pants stuff, doesn't it? And a very, very good win for Brady Gilmore against Godon, who was second. But it feels to me, Daniel, like we've done the combination of 2 one-day races and a stage race. We should probably wrap it up and get our feet up for the Tour of Flanders.
Yeah, try and recover. Try and try to regain some sort of health, fitness, morale, and general momentum in our lives. Anyway, Lionel, that is about it for this episode. But we will be back in Arrivé on Sunday.
Sunday, we will. Very quickly, my mini-series, I've called it Roadbook. It's a sort of quasi-travel guide to the Spring Classics, the second episode about the Flandrian races that we're living through at the moment, is online for Friends of the Podcast subscribers. Now you can subscribe annually at thecyclingpodcast.com, or I think you can subscribe month to month as well. So if anything catches your eye, you could subscribe for a month, listen to everything you like, and then unsubscribe again. We don't mind you doing that at all. So that's thecyclingpodcast.com. And the next episode of that mini-series will cover Paris-Roubaix, and it will be out sometime next week in the run-up to the Hell of the North.
Excellent. We'll be back on Sunday. Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Daniel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Burnett.